Good morning. This is hour number two of our morning talk program, Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about slavery in the world today. And there might be some people who would be surprised to hear that, in fact, slavery does exist in the world, now nearly 200 years after the slave trade was abolished. But it is, in fact, that not only does slavery still exist, there are more slaves alive today than at any time in human history. The number, the estimate, 27 million. And that is an estimate that's been developed by the man that we'll be talking with this morning. His name is Kevin Bales. He's president of an organization called Free the Slaves. That is the U.S. sister organization to Britain's Anti-Slavery International. He's professor emeritus at Roehampton University in London. And he is someone who has become quite well known for speaking about and writing about this particular issue. He's the author of a book titled Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy, that was published in 1999, and a new book that has just come out that carries the subject further. The title is Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. This book is published by the University of California Press. And also, the organization we mentioned here, Free the Slaves, does indeed also have a website. So if you're interested in finding more about the issue or about this organization, you can go to www.freetheslaves.net, and you can get that if you have the internet access. And this morning, as we talk with our guest, Kevin Bales, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL, 9455. Either way, that'll work for you. So 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL or 9455. At any point here, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions. The only thing we ask is that people are just brief, if as they can be, just so we can keep things moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But certainly anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Mr. Bales, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm just interested, perhaps to begin, to ask a question about yourself. How is it that you became interested in investigating the subject?
You know, I was living in London and teaching there, and at a public event, I picked up a leaflet that said on the front of it, there are millions of slaves in the world today, which came as a big surprise to me, as it, I think it still comes to many people in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
I was, in fact, teaching human rights. I felt I should have known this, and that pushed me very hard in my curiosity to try and find out what was going on. I discovered there was very little analysis and understanding of the issue, but though there was some outrage and sensation about it. And so I began to do research in the field. And that's really what changed me, I have to say, is when I began to meet people in slavery in different countries in the world, I was very shocked and I was very deeply moved, and I realized I couldn't just go back to the classroom and talk about this. I needed to take action.
27 million, that's quite a stunning number, and I'm sure that this is an estimate. How did one come up with a number like that?
Well, indeed it's an estimate. It's a hidden crime, but I assembled a research team. We spent about 3 years building that number up from other estimates and other reports from all the countries in the world, and testing those numbers to see how trustworthy they were, and then also checking each country's estimate with local experts as well. So it was originally an estimate from my own research team, but about 5 years afterwards, the International Labor Organization of the United Nations did the same exercise in an even more sophisticated way and came up with fundamentally the same number.
You say that virtually in almost every country there are people who are slaves, indeed also including the United States. Are there, though, places where there are greater numbers of people in bondage than in other places?
Oh, absolutely. Around the world, the greatest number of slaves exist in those countries which are the poorest and which also suffer from governmental corruption, because if the rule of law will not protect you from slavery, you're more likely to be caught up in slavery, and in those countries where there have been traditions of slavery. So the greatest number of slaves around the world are actually in South Asia, in the countries of India, Pakistan, Nepal, and Bangladesh.
And are those people who are enslaved in their home countries, their country of origin, or are these people who had been brought from somewhere else to the place where they were?
Well, the vast majority are, in fact, what we would call sedentary slaves, slaves that have not been trafficked across borders. Mm-hmm. There are trafficked people in slavery in India that have been young women who have been trafficked into prostitution from Nepal, for example. But millions of people are caught in hereditary forms of slavery in South Asia. And likewise, in West Africa, we have long-standing forms of slavery, and particularly Northwest African countries like Mali, Niger, and Mauritania.
Yeah, that is one of the ways in which slavery, as it exists today, perhaps is different than it has been in the past, and that is that so many people are in some form of debt bondage.
Well, I wouldn't say it just that way, simply
no.
Because, to the best of our understanding, those forms of debt bondage that exist, hereditary collateral debt bondage that exist in South Asia, mm-hmm. have been operating for more than 1,000 years. So it's a long part of human history, that particular kind of debt bondage. It's a little odd to an American ear to understand about collateral debt bondage, so that it's not about a debt that you just have to repay. In fact, when you borrow the money, usually because of a crisis, because you must buy medicine to save your child's life, something like that, you have to give over to the moneylender your own family and you and all of the work that you can do as collateral until the debt is repaid. The moneylender says, well, you don't have anything to offer as collateral, so I have to take you and your family as collateral.
Hmm.
Well, obviously, if someone owns you as collateral until you repay a debt, how on earth can you repay it? And the answer is you can't, and for that reason, we see families in which that debt is passed down generation after generation. And I've met families in their fifth generation of slavery against an original debt of some minuscule sum, like $10 or $20.
Yeah. And that's what's just remarkable, amazing about this kind of situation, that people would be in a place where essentially the nature of it, the structure of it, it's set up so that, in fact, they can never pay back the debt. It's almost a guarantee that they, it wouldn't matter how hard they worked. They would never be able to work themselves out of slavery.
I've only met one person who's come out of slavery independently, as it were, without someone stepping in from the outside, and that was through a rare situation in which his wife had a distant relative who left them some money, and it reached them, and they used that to pay off their debt. But because there was no input from anti-slavery workers or any kind of rehabilitation work, that man stayed out of slavery about 6 months and then went back to his master and said, will you take me back? Because he felt such enormous insecurity in freedom, because he had no help to understand what it meant to live in an autonomous and self-directed way.
Just quickly, let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Kevin Bales. He is one of the, if not the world's leading expert on modern slavery. It's something he has been writing about and talking about for a number of years now. He's president of the organization Free the Slaves, which is the American sister organization to Britain's Anti-Slavery International. They have a website that I mentioned if you're interested in finding out more, which is freetheslaves.net. He has written several books on the subject. The most recent is Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves, and it's published by the University of California Press. The number here, if you'd like to call in with a question, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. As you mentioned and you discuss in the book, slavery is something that has existed, as far as we know, throughout history. One thing, though, that certainly is different today has to do with the value of the slave and, in fact, the great crash in what a person in slavery today is worth.
That's exactly right. In many ways, there's only one new thing about slavery. Slavery, in terms of the relationship between slave and master, has been pretty much identical in its exploitation and violence for the last 5,000 to 6,000 years. The one thing that's new that's occurred really in the last 30 to 40 years is a complete collapse in the price of human beings, the acquisition cost of human beings. And that's all down to the fact that the population explosion, particularly in the developing world, has built what I think a lot of us have heard of, 1 billion people living on $1 a day in great destitution and vulnerability. Having a lot of poor people doesn't make them slaves, but if you add in corruption, governmental corruption, which means they're not protected from being subjected to the violence of slavery, that very large number of very poor people and vulnerable people can be harvested into slavery. And there's such a glut of potential slaves on the market today that the price of a human being has fallen to around $100 on average worldwide. And that's compared to an average across most of human history of the equivalent of about $40,000 in today's money.
Mm. So that just the one result is that one can regard people essentially as disposable items. If you wear one out, they die. Well, it's really not that difficult for you to go out and get another one.
Exactly correct. And, in the past, slaves, while they were treated brutally often, they were often cared for as well because they represented such an investment. Today, there's no reason if you're the kind of criminal who would use slave labor to care for them in terms of medical needs or diet, it's just as easy to throw them away if they're sick or injured or to kill them and then to replace them at low cost.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who is listening here in Urbana, where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi, I have two completely unrelated questions, and I'll hang up and listen. The first is, I'm guessing that your numbering of slaves does not include women who are essentially culturally slaves, especially in a number of Asian countries where, at least from my standpoint, they would be no different from slaves, and I would like you to address that difference, if you would. And the second unrelated question is that there, at least a few years ago, was a movement in the West, especially in the U.S., to purchase slaves' freedom. And I remember reading that a lot of people said that was counterproductive because they would just go out and get more slaves. And I'd like you to just discuss that phenomenon, especially given your description of these people who've been slaves for generations. And it looks like if you're going to purchase slaves' freedoms, that might be a good target. But please just address those. I'll hang up and listen.
Right. Bill, caller, could I ask you, could you give me an example of what you meant by a woman in South Asia who, where is he gone?
Well, he rang off, I'm afraid.
Okay, all right, no worries. I wasn't precisely clear about what he was referring to. I think he's referring to unfree forms of marriage in which women are shifted from one family to the next, often with payments being a part of that, such as in Afghanistan, which is a fairly well-documented example of that. Those are, in fact, defined as forms of slavery by the United Nations Convention and very much come within our work. I have to say, though, that those unfree forms of marriage and treatment of women are understood, but not so much from the direction of how they fit within the overall issue of slavery. What I mean by that is it's very difficult at the moment because we simply haven't done enough research in this area to know exactly where to draw the line, to put women who are exploited in the same way that we put workers who are exploited on one side of the line and women or workers who are enslaved on the other side of the line. In terms of the question about the redemption movement, which is what it was called when people were buying people out of slavery, we as an organization have a policy that we simply don't do that. Slavery is illegal in every country. Buying a person out of slavery is a lot like paying a burglar to get your television back. It's in a sense, supporting that criminal activity. On the other hand, I will say we have one exception to our policy, and that exists when if we find a person in slavery whose life is in danger and there is no legal remedy that we can bring to bear There's no other way to make sure that a person literally survives or goes without suffering violence immediately than we would act in that way. But in fact, the people who are in hereditary debt bondage, we find the best way to bring them out, and we've now worked with thousands of villages in Asia, where thousands of people who have come out of slavery from exactly that kind of slavery, we do best not by buying them out, but by sending in activists to help them to realize their own political power and their own recognition that they have a right to freedom, and they will act to bring themselves to freedom.
Just, I guess the first question of the caller does suggest that sometimes the where it is we draw the line to do the definition of slavery might be a little difficult, in the sense that there are people who are in situations where they don't really have control over their lives, don't have true mobility, and it would be very difficult for them to leave. Technically speaking, they could if they wanted to. No one's going to shoot them if they step outside the door, but they might not be able to survive very well if they step outside the door. But we are indeed talking about that kind of difference where someone is truly being held against their will, and it's not so much a thing that where it would be difficult to leave for them, but they could. It's a situation where one truly is being held prisoner.
You know, for all of human history, there was very little doubt what slavery meant. And it meant someone who literally could not walk away without fearing extreme violence, who was held against their will and had no free will. Since the abolition of legal slavery, there has sort of grown a certain amount of confusion as the word has been extended to lots of other ideas, in part to dramatize those ideas. But it's true that if we're going to be strict, which we try to be in terms of identifying people who are actually in slavery, our rule of thumb is to say, can this person walk away even if it's into a worse situation? And if they can make that choice, then they're not a slave. Now, that's not to say they're not in horrific situations of exploitation and degradation and so forth, and those are very serious problems, but they're not slavery.
Just, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about the way in which forces in the global economy tend to create a situation that fosters slavery, and that's one, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that there are now more slaves alive than have ever been in American history, that population maybe has something to do with that. Are there other ways in which the realities of today's global economy helps to foster slavery or to create the environment in which it can operate?
Oh, yes. Particularly in the developing world, almost anything that can destabilize a country and a society will foster slavery. So it can be misguided World Bank policies or IMF policies that create the need to shift funds into debt repayment instead of building the schools and the healthcare and the infrastructure needed to build up your society and your citizenship so that they are not vulnerable to slavery. It can be anything that involves increasing the amount of governmental corruption. Corruption is, in fact, the strongest predictor of how much slavery or human trafficking exists in any country. So when, for example, North American and Western European companies go into the developing world and use bribery as a way to shift governmental policies to suit their needs, that increases the amount of corruption in the country, sets a tone which works down to the local level. And in fact, then, creates a context that would increase slavery. But so many other things as well, like armed conflict, civil war, environmental destruction, or environmental disasters like a tsunami, all of those things, when the rule of law is shaken or broken in a country, slavery will blossom.
And just to kind of underscore two things that you have said. We've already talked a little bit about one, that there are slaves in almost all of the countries on the earth. The other is that in all of the countries, or almost all the countries, I suppose, on the earth, it is technically illegal.
Absolutely. Exactly right. I think it is worth saying, though, that you were pointing out that there are more slaves alive today than probably at any time in human history. Uh-huh. But there's a flip side to that, which is, of course, that 27 million is a lot of slaves, but it's actually, as well, the smallest proportion of the global population to ever be in slavery.
Right.
And that actually is a point of hope and a positive point.
Well, if indeed, wherever you go, if there are slaves and slavery is also illegal, this must also suggest that people who are involved in government, people who are involved in law enforcement, know that slavery exists. So at the same time as there may be efforts to make sure that it doesn't happen, it must also be that many places, people in government or local law enforcement are in collusion, or at least they're aware that it's going on, and they're allowing it to go on.
Well, that's certainly the case with corruption. I mean, around the world, there are countries have different levels of corruption, and the countries in which the police and the lawmakers are in fact aware of the amount of slavery going on and collude with it, those are the places where it's absolutely the most difficult to root out. And that even applies to some of the developed countries like Japan, that has a very large number of human trafficking victims being brought into the country each year. The government is doing practically nothing about it. And from what we can understand, a number of the politicians are in fact supported by the Yakuza organized crime groups in Japan to make sure that this trade continues. On the other hand, it's also true that governments are not always as swift and clever about reacting to problems as we would hope. And in the United States, we have a government that has certainly talked a good line, but they haven't necessarily backed that up with the resources necessary to get the job done. So we spend about $250 million a year on all forms of slavery and human trafficking on the entire earth from the U.S. budget, which is simply a drop in the ocean of what's actually needed to combat this crime, not least because this is a major crime within the United States, which is receiving nowhere near the resources that any of the other criminal activities receive in the United States.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned a little bit earlier that we have this very significant number, 27 million. We believe, and that's an estimate, we believe that there are 27 million people in slavery in the world today, and that they're found all around the world, mostly in South Asia, but in a lot of other places, including the United States. Mm-hmm. What would be your, and I guess it may be not just your estimate, I think the United States government has a number for this, an estimate of the number of people who are slaves now today in the United States?
Well, my best estimate would be, and this would be a very conservative estimate, would be something in the range of 40,000. The U.S. government, CIA State Department research suggests that about 14,500 to 17,500 people are brought into the United States each year to be newly enslaved in the United States. And we know from other research that we've done for the United Nations that people stay in slavery on average for 3 to 5 years in the United States. I've known cases up to 28 years. I've known them as short as 2 months when they were able to be rescued. But if you just take the lower end of all of those averages and say, what does that come to? It comes to about 40,000 people.
And what sort of work are these people doing?
Well, again, according to the work that we did for the UN, what we found was that just under half, something like 46-47%, were had been enslaved into prostitution. That the next largest group, something like 20%, were enslaved in domestic service, being kept as servants in people's homes. And then the next group, something like 10-15%, were in agricultural work, primarily in along the southern borders of the United States. And then after that, there were an incredibly large number of possible ways, because criminals can be very clever, of exploiting people who are enslaved. And so everything from a boys' choir from Zambia that were part of a charity scam to Peruvians enslaved in a cannoli factory on Long Island, the list went on and on.
We are at our midpoint of this part of Focus 580. Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Kevin Bales. He is president of Free the Slaves. It is the U.S. sister organization of Britain's Anti-Slavery International. They have a website if you'd like to find out more about this organization or about the issue, which is freetheslaves.net. He is a professor emeritus at Roehampton University in London and author of several books on this subject, including Disposable People, published in 1999, Understanding Global Slavery, published in 2005, and a newly published book titled Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. And I believe they're all published by the University of California Press, and I think all still in print. So if you're interested in reading some more about this issue, you can go out and look for the books, or indeed, as I said, look at the website for the organization. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, one of the big things I know that you're working to do and have been for some time now is simply to raise awareness about this issue, as you said, I think earlier on, that that people continue to be surprised, or say that they're surprised, when they hear that there is slavery in the world today. How helpful do you think it would be? How far could you advance the mission of getting rid of slavery by simply bringing it to the attention of more people around the world that, in fact, there is slavery?
Oh, that is absolutely the essential first step in the eradication of slavery. The actual costs of getting people out of slavery are fairly low in terms of bringing about the projects and the workers that necessary to do that job. And the fact that the laws are in place in every country mean that, you know, the job is not about getting this made illegal. It's simply about getting that job of arrest and prosecution and liberation done. But to do that, you have to have governments step up and do what they promised to do when they passed the law. And to do that, you have to get the constituents and democracies and the citizens to ask and insist that, in fact, countries do what they promised to do when they passed the law. And until there's a broader understanding of contemporary slavery and people are willing to take that awareness and turn it into a commitment to act, we're still going to be languishing with a very large number of people in slavery. Yeah. But when we achieve that broad awareness and that broad commitment, I think we'll see some very dramatic changes happening very quickly.
We have someone to talk with here again, someone to bring into the conversation, listening in Danville, nearby community. This is Line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Question. I know some of the first court cases and legislation to abolish slavery was in England. And I was wondering if you could kind of inform us as to what time period that was.
Certainly. The first major victory of the first anti-slavery campaign was in 1807, when the British Parliament stopped the slave trade. Not slavery itself, it stopped the slave trade within the British Empire. Previous to that, there had been some legal cases that had raised an enormous amount of awareness. One was a case in which a slave ship captain had thrown over 100 people off over the side of his ship when they were still alive so he could claim insurance on his lost cargo. And the insurance companies resisted that in court, but it dramatized the inhumanity of that. Go ahead.
When was that?
That was in 1796.
Okay. Great. All right, well, that answers my question. I knew that was a time period, you know, late 1700s, early 1800s.
Well, our organization that we're part of, which is now called Anti-Slavery International in Britain, was actually the very first group that formed against slavery in an independent way. And we our first meeting was in May of 1787, and we've been operating continuously since then.
Great. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks. And of course, it was sadly the case that ending the slave trade did not end slavery.
No, it took another 25 years to end legal slavery within the British Empire, and then another 30-some years after that to, for example, to end legal slavery in the United States. Legal slavery in Brazil didn't end until 1888. And then in many of the Middle Eastern countries, like Saudi Arabia and Yemen and so forth, legal slavery didn't end until just after the Second World War.
Is this an issue that is being addressed by the United Nations?
Oh, yes. Certainly the United Nations was very clear. Even before it was the United Nations and it was the League of Nations in the 1920s, it enacted the first global anti-slavery conventions, putting a stamp on it to said, you know, this is a global issue, and there's a global response to it, which is correct. The United Nations is in many of its sub-agencies doing very excellent work on anti-slavery, but it's also true that the leadership of the United Nations, which exists in the Security Council, hasn't really devoted any time or attention to this, and I don't think we'll see significant results from the United Nations until the Security Council takes it up and makes it a priority.
How is there any way of knowing what what sort of products might be the result of slave labor, so that if an individual, at least if you said, well, one thing I don't want to do is to put my money into a product that was produced by slaves, so I don't want to, very least I'm going to say I'm not going to buy that thing if I knew. Is there actually any way to know?
Well, there is indeed, but in fact, not buying may be the worst thing you can do. And let me explain that, you know, I suspect every listener today has the products of slavery in their homes. There's slavery in cotton, sugar, coffee, tea, cocoa and chocolate, in the steel, in their furniture and cars, in the tantalum, which is a mineral in their cell phones and laptop computers. The list goes on and on. The thing that makes it very difficult to address with boycott, however, is that the amount of slavery in any one commodity or product today is a very, very small fraction. So, for example, in the sugar that we use, it may be that only 1% of that sugar has been touched by slavery, or 1% of the chocolate that we eat has been touched by slavery. And if we boycott, we harm the other 99 honest farmers who didn't use slave labor, you know, in an attempt to harm and stop the one farmer who did. So boycotting isn't usually the right idea these days. The right idea is to instead to devote resources to chasing down the slavery where it occurs at the farm where the farmer is, in fact, a criminal slaveholder, and stopping it there, not by creating a boycott that can harm honest people who aren't involved in slavery.
How many do you know, or does anybody know, how many of the 27 million people we're talking about in slavery are children?
No one knows that for certain. I think we can assume that when we look at most of the slavery around the world and we see whole families in slavery, that it's got to be a sizable proportion. I would say it's somewhere over 10%, but probably not as high as 30%. But a lot of people, and not least because disposability of children is high and children are nimble and can be worked hard. The fact that often their birth is not registered. There are many countries where they won't have a birth certificate, so in a sense they don't exist legally, which makes them easier to exploit and to enslave. Children are very much part of the world of modern slavery.
Mm. Well, as an individual, and if one was concerned about this issue, we talked a little bit about boycotting certain products, and you said, "Well, that's really not a very good strategy because it ends up hurting a lot of people, and doesn't do a very good job of getting at the issue that you're really talking about." And of course, one could support organizations like yours who have this as a specific issue, but in other ways, as an individual, is there much that a person could do?
Well, indeed, of course there are. There's several things you can do. One is, for example, on our website, we have a booklet that's called The Community Member's Guide, and it's written for and by Americans about slavery in America today. And it tells you how you would be able to identify someone who had been trafficked and enslaved in the United States, in your neighborhood, in your town. It gives examples of stories of people just like you and me who have realized that there was slavery in their neighborhood and done something about it, and it gives you the numbers to call if you actually think you've got a situation like that in your community. So that's exactly the kind of information that if you just know that information and the situation ever arises, you'd be able to take a step in your own hometown that could get somebody out of slavery.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How do you, or can one at all, differentiate between slavery and the hundreds of millions of people that communist governments have forced into village re-education camps or that type of communization of agriculture where the peasants have no way of running away even if they wanted to, because first of all because of physical force, but also because of the economic reality that they have nowhere else to go. Is that category of people slaves or not?
That category of people could well be enslaved, and let me point particularly to the country of Burma today. It's been in the news a lot lately, but it's been on the watch list of anti-slavery groups for a good 20 years. This is a country which practices forced labor. In other words, it's a country where the government itself is engaged in the enslavement of its own citizens. And there's no doubt about that. We understand that. It's been very well documented, filmed, photographed, transcripts and testimonies have been taken. And that's not unlike the situations that had occurred in the past in certain of the old communist governments. And, of course, you can point to that and say that is state-sponsored slavery. A similar situation exists in China today, in which large numbers of people, hundreds of thousands of people, have been enslaved in prison factories. And the reason why we use the word slavery as opposed to saying that they are convict workers is because there's been no due process of law. There's been no trial, sometimes not even charges, simply arrest, and then followed immediately by imprisonment. This is very clearly not about a legal system operating fairly. It's clearly about the harvesting of workers into a factory system, sometimes based on their being of the wrong religious group or having divergent political views. But it's very much also a money-making operation for the Chinese government, who run these factories in their prisons to make goods which are exported directly to the United States and to increase their balance of payments.
That brings me to a similar, different aspect of it. If exploitation by the government for economic reasons is one form of slavery, it is a counterpart or a parallel to the same reason, exploitation for economic reasons, by private citizens that we talk about mostly in South Asian countries, where people could physically get away, but economically not. And so it's just a matter of form, I guess, if not semantics, whether the slavery in China is any different than, say, slavery in South Asia or Burma or India.
Well, I have to say this, though. If a person can walk away, even into a situation which is worse than the one that they're in, we do not classify that, and nor would most people for the history of the planet have classified that as slavery. I appreciate the enormous and damaging levels of exploitation that occur, for example, in sweatshops in Southeast Asia. It's a terrible situation that many workers find themselves in. But it's not slavery until they're locked in and prevented from leaving and paid nothing. You know, the criteria for enslavement is that you're under total violent control, that you cannot walk away, that you're being economically exploited, and that you're paid nothing beyond subsistence. Now, there certainly have been sweatshop factories, even in American territories, which have met those criteria and enslaved their workers. But there are others which are, you know, just over the line. And I'm not trying to diminish in any way the situation of that exploitation. But it hasn't crossed the line, maybe I should say, yet, into slavery.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is someone listening in Kankakee on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Your caller would comment that it appears to him as though slavery has been or is being reestablished in the United States through such devices as internet, net slavery, and through the refusal of employers to pay earned salaries, etc. Your caller wonders if his observation bears any resonance with the guest, and if so, what might the remedies be? Thank you.
Well, is the question clear, Mr. Bass?
I think so. He seems to be asking if in fact, highly exploitative and insufficient payment in jobs are tantamount to slavery. They are not. It's a terrible situation. It's highly exploitative. But I think we just have to remember that slavery is slavery. You know, I think if you were to go back and ask Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman, you know, great abolitionist ex-slave heroes of American past, and say, here's someone who's chosen to take a job. It turned out the job was much worse than they expected. In fact, their boss is cheating them. They're not paying them correctly, and so forth. Is this person a slave? They would have laughed at you. They said, no, you know, this is a person who's ended up in a bad situation, which many people do, which is, in fact, one of the outcomes of having free choice, is that you can choose to go to situations which are not good for you. But that's not the same as slavery, where you have no choices whatsoever.
Yeah, I think that that's a good point. I think that what I hear you saying is that while, yes, it is true that there are many different kinds of workers who are being exploited and taken advantage of, maybe one should be a little careful about using the word slavery, because it does have a very clear definition, and there is a big difference between someone who might consider himself a wage slave, and maybe a lot of us might, and someone who is truly, in the strict definition of the word, a slave.
That's right. You know, after the greatest part of North American, Western European population decided that slavery was a thing of the past, the word slave and the word slavery kind of went up for grabs. And people began to use it to talk about, you know, people who couldn't stop shopping, or people who were in bad relationships, or people who couldn't stop eating chocolate, or whatever. And it sort of diluted the meaning of it. And you even began to have newspaper accounts that would say something like, the person was found, they had been locked in the same room for 15 years, they had been chained, they had been whipped and beaten, they had been forced to work, they had been paid absolutely nothing. So these were slave-like conditions. Well, you know, is it slave-like or is it slavery if a person is locked up for years and not paid and beaten and so forth? We used to write letters to any journalist who wrote something and said, you know, we found a person on the street who's been shot through the heart and they're laying there with their eyes rolled up. Is this a death-like condition?
Yeah, the point is really clear. And I suppose it does go back to as we've said several times here, that you have to make the point with people that, in fact, true slavery, absolute, you know, book definition slavery, does continue to exist, that it's not just a thing of the past. It exists now, and even in here in the United States, there are people who are true, by the book, slaves.
Absolutely. But, you know, the thing that in some ways is the most important news is not that slavery exists today, because it's existed since for at least 5,000 years. Hmm. The thing that the good news is that it could be a thing of the past. The fact that the proportion of people in slavery in the world is the smallest it's ever been, that the role that slavery plays in the global economy is so minute as to be negligible, and that we've got a law against it in every country and a pretty universal agreement among the people of the world that we shouldn't have slavery means that it's possible to bring it to an end today.
Yeah. I have another caller here, and just very quickly, though, I'd like to introduce one more time our guest, Kevin Bales. He is president of Free the Slaves. It is the American sister organization of Britain's Anti-Slavery International, a very old organization working on this issue. They have a website, if you'd like to find out more, which is freetheslaves.net. He is professor emeritus at Roehampton University in London and may be one of the world's leading authorities on contemporary slavery. He's authored several books on the subject, including the most recent, which is titled Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. It's published by the University of California Press and does indeed have some suggestions to make on how one could deal with this issue, how we could deal with this issue of slavery on the level of the individual and the community and the nation and in terms of international organizations as well, on all of those various levels, and you can find that in the book. We have somebody else here, I think, to talk with on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have one small, perhaps conceptual point. From an existentialist point of view, we're all free to resist at any point, and from that perspective, even a slave can resist. So I understand your general point that slavery is something distinct from being paid low wages or minimal wages in a sweatshop, but given that we're talking about degrees of coercion versus liberty, I'm curious to know why we need to have, an, as the host said just a minute ago, an absolute definition. There really isn't an absolute definition, is there? And if not, doesn't that have bearing on how we critique the widening gap between the rich and the poor and how that affects people at the bottom end of even our own society?
Well, no, I think there is an absolute definition because we're describing a relationship between two people, not necessarily the existentialist position of any person's mind. It's a relationship between a person who controls one person totally and the other person who is subjected to that control. And, of course, a person in slavery can resist as best they can. They will pay the price for that resistance, but, of course, they can resist. And you could starve yourself or commit suicide to get yourself out of slavery, but that's not a very good choice. I don't think it's necessarily helpful to begin to think through all the possible permutations of the psychology of enslavement. But in particular because I've met a lot of people in slavery, and I've been able to explore with them how they feel about their situation of enslavement. And for them, it is not a complicated or existentialist question. It's a question of the fact that they are not allowed to achieve any form of free will, any form of setting that out of life, and particularly caring for their own loved ones. This is especially the case with women who are enslaved, because around the world, people who are enslaved doing different kinds of work, brick-making, agricultural work, whatever, men and women are forced to do the same work, but the women will be systematically sexually assaulted as well. This has always been the case with slavery throughout history, and it is the case today. I think it's important to make sure we understand that that relationship between two people is slavery, because that particular relationship needs to be rooted out of our human existence. And, of course, you can discuss and debate the nature of the psychology of that. But most important is to give it a clear understanding and a clear definition so that we can identify it in order to root it out.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And indeed, other questions, if someone wants to call real quick, we can accommodate you before the end. We have a minute or two left. I guess, one sort of basic point I wanted to make sure that we make, and that is not to, to continue to talk about this problem and how serious it is and how it's been with us for as far as we know, for perhaps all of human history, that should not make you feel that this is something that's an insoluble problem. I think one of the important points that you try to make, I'm sure, is that it is actually possible. It should actually be possible for us, human beings, to end slavery. And it's not at all unreasonable to think that we could see, within our lifetimes, we could see the end of slavery.
Wouldn't it be amazing to create a watershed in human history and say, from the very first written records of human beings, we have slavery, and it exists up till now, some 5,000 or 6,000 years later, and yet from this point on, we're going to give a gift to the world of a world without slavery. In fact, you know, we've been working on the last 5 years to determine what are the costs of bringing people out of slavery. What are the most efficient ways to do so? And what we've discovered is that the costs are relatively low. At a sort of median expense, and I don't mean buying people out of slavery, but just helping them out of slavery. We've determined that the expense of bringing 27 million people out of slavery is something like $11 billion. Which is a lot more money than I have or you have, but it's what Americans spend on pretzels and potato chips in 1 year.
Well, how do you figure, and what exactly does a number like that represent the value of these people's labor, or
it's in fact the cost that is required to send workers in and do both the liberation work, rehabilitation work, and then the work of helping families to achieve autonomy citizenship, education, and dignity. We do not stop working when someone achieves freedom. We keep going until they're full citizenships. We don't want to ever repeat the botched emancipation that occurred in the United States in 1865, where 4 million people were set free, which was good, but then dumped into an economy without access to credit or capital, without access to political participation or education, and then discriminated and subject to prejudice. That was a terrible way to bring slavery to an end, and we still pay the price in the United States for that botched emancipation of 1865. So it's what it is the cost of that process of liberation to true freedom. And the median cost of that across all of the projects that we've been working on is something around $400 to $500. It's much lower in places like India where costs are low. In the United States, the cost is going to be several tens of thousands of dollars to bring a person out of slavery. But most of the people in slavery around the world are living in those countries where the cost of liberation and rehabilitation is pretty low. So you multiply up 27 million times something like $400, and you reach a sum of about $11 billion. Hmm.
And it sounds as if the bottom line here is that as much people can move on this at an individual community level, the government of every country where slavery exists is going to have to consider this to be a serious issue and going to have to make that a priority within its own borders.
Absolutely. The good news is that every country has made a promise to its own citizens by passing a law and saying, this is going to be what we allow and don't allow in our country.
Well, we are at the point now where in our conversation we're going to have to stop. I do want to mention one more time that, first of all, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that we have talked about, Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. It is published by the University of California Press by our guest, Kevin Bales. He is president of Free the Slaves. And if you're interested in finding out more, again, about the issue or about this particular organization, you can go to their website, which is freetheslaves.net. Free the Slaves is the sister organization of Britain's Anti-Slavery International. Our guest, Kevin Bales, is professor emeritus at Roehampton University in London, and in fact has authored also a couple of other books on the same subject, Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy, and Understanding Global Slavery there, and all three of the books published by the University of California Press. Mr. Bales, thank you very much for being our guest this morning. We appreciate it.
I've had a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Bodywork Associates now has an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. And that's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more in the way of news and features and other things coming up, all as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with writer Catherine Min. She will join us following the 1 o'clock news. We turn our attention now to commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat, 8.11 and a half, down 10 and 3 quarters. In Chicago, December wheat, 7.90, down 7. March, 8.11, down 9 and a half. July, 6.84, down 2. December corn, 3.84 and a quarter, down 1.5. March 4.